Hello, true crime fans. Thanks for tuning in to another episode of Always Time for True Crime. Or maybe you're new here, in which case, welcome. I'm your host, Julia, and today I'm going to be telling you about the totally senseless murder of a 17-year-old girl. When Shauna Card was found stabbed to death in her own home, nothing about the crime made sense. The motive, the suspects. And while police did eventually get their guy, some of the puzzle pieces still don't fit into a complete story. Mainly because Shauna's family is still just wondering why. Without further ado, let's get into the story of Shauna Card. Shauna Marie Card was born January 8, 1978 in Stoughton, Massachusetts, to parents Pauline and Kent Card, and raised alongside one brother, Chris. When she was 11, the family moved to Orlando, Florida, but shortly after their relocation, her parents divorced. In 1992, when she was 14, her dad Kent got remarried to her stepmother, Beverly. Shauna was known as a really good kid. A ray of sunshine, she was called. She never wanted anybody to be upset or to be in a foul mood, so her dad said that she was a peacekeeper, always smiling and just making sure that everyone else was happy too. All of her fellow classmates said the same thing. She was the sweetest girl. Quiet at times, but many used the word unassuming. In her spare time, Shauna volunteered at the local hospital, as she had dreams of becoming a physical therapist, hopefully with children. She really loves kids, and she wanted that to be involved in her work. Which is honestly amazing to not only know what you want to do and to be so passionate about it at such a young age. Like, I think we forget how young 17 is. I had no idea what I was doing. I mean, I still have no idea what I'm doing. But Shauna not only had her dreams set out, she was actively making steps to achieve those. On top of volunteering at the hospital, she assisted as a student medic for the football team, tending to the injured players. At the time of her murder in 1995, Shauna was reportedly doing really well. Her parents had gotten divorced, as I mentioned, and her dad had remarried, but she was apparently handling that pretty well. For the most part, she got along with her stepmother, Beverly, who actually referred to Shauna as her daughter. Like, she respected Pauline as her mom. Beverly makes a point to say that she wasn't trying to be her mother, but she very much loved Shauna as her own and wanted to be, like, another mentor for her. She said that when Kent and Pauline were both too nervous to take Shauna driving after she got her learner's permit, Beverly got in the passenger seat and let Shauna practice in her car. But as we know, teenagers are quite difficult, and sometimes adding another parental figure into the mix makes it more turbulent. Near the end of 1994, Shauna was fighting a lot with her dad and stepmom. They had a different parenting style than Pauline did, and it seems like they were more strict with her. I'm not here to say what's wrong and what's right. I'm sure both were fantastic parents. But Pauline said that she really trusted her daughter. She knew Shauna was a good kid. She never gave her any reason not to trust her, and so they kind of just had that dynamic where the two respected one another. And they had that mutual understanding. So Shauna was free to go out with her friends when she wanted, and Pauline just kind of trusted that Shauna would be back for curfew, and she would get her homework done on time, and that just worked for them. Kent and Beverly, though, it's not like they didn't trust Shauna, I'm sure they did, because like I said, she was a good kid, but they wanted to know where she was at all times. Again, both styles work for different people. Shauna wasn't allowed to date, have friends over to the house without asking, or even go to school dances. Her dad had a rule that Shauna was to do her homework as soon as she got home from school, so that when he got home from work, they could all have dinner together. Shauna had expressed to some of her friends that she wished her dad had treated her more maturely, and that she was also having some trouble with Beverly being a disciplinarian. It was like the classic typical fight that many teens have with step-parents. Like this, you're not my mom, so you shouldn't be telling me what to do, kind of thing. And so for a few weeks before her murder, she moved back to her mom's place. I'm not totally sure whether she was doing like half and half, going back and forth, or whether she was fully at her dad's house at that point. But she decided to completely go back to living with Pauline until things cooled down. And Pauline was really happy to have her. They had a really good relationship. In an episode of On the Case with Paula Zahn, Pauline said, quote, "I really enjoyed her company. We really had a good time together. You know, whether we were shopping or watching TV, whatever we were doing, I really enjoyed the time." End quote. That quote just really got to me. I don't know, I think saying you enjoy someone's company is such a nice, sincere, yet really simple thing to say. For a teenage girl and her mother to just genuinely enjoy spending time together. Because I know that's kind of like a difficult age, or like with the child-parent relationship. Or maybe it's just not cool to hang out with your mom. But just how Pauline describes their relationship, I just know that both of them loved being together. On January 31st, 1995, the day started off like any other. Pauline went to work, Shauna went to school. I know I haven't really mentioned her brother Chris very much. He was actually living out of state at the time, I assume maybe off at university. So he wasn't around at the time of Shauna's murder. Shauna got off the school bus around 2 p.m. and, as always, called her mom at work to let her know that she had gotten safe. Pauline said that the last time she talked to her daughter, she sounded happy. For the past, like, 3 months, her soap operas hadn't been on because the O.J. Simpson trial had been taking up every channel. Clearly, Shauna didn't like true crime as much as we do. But she was really excited that her shows were back on. Shauna called her mother a second time a little bit later that afternoon to ask her a quick homework question. It's also reported that she chatted on the phone with a girlfriend around 4 p.m. Just after 6, Pauline arrived home with some takeout that she and Shauna were going to have for dinner. But as soon as she stepped inside, she knew something was wrong. Because it was dead silent. And Pauline knew that even when Shauna was doing homework, she'd have something playing in the background, either the TV or the radio. The second clue was that even when she called her name, Shauna didn't reply. Pauline walked further down the hallway, ducking her head inside Shauna's room. She then saw the bathroom. The door was open just a crack, enough that she could tell that the light was on. As Pauline pushed on the door, she found her only daughter collapsed on the floor between the toilet and the bathtub, covered in blood. There were a number of weapons, including a steak knife, lying beside her. Pauline fell to the floor and grabbed her daughter's hand, but she was cold. Pauline said that's when she knew that Shauna was gone. And in fact, Pauline said that her first thought was that Shauna had committed suicide. Not because Shauna was even dealing with those kind of thoughts, or because the scene looked like suicide, but just because what else could have happened? I mean, you don't expect your teenage daughter to be savagely murdered in your own home, right? She quickly ran to the kitchen to call 911, but of course, she was hysterical. She was screaming that her daughter is dead, and the dispatcher couldn't really understand the whole situation. So they told Pauline to go over to a neighbor's house. Just get away from the apartment and that the police are on their way. After she hung up with 911, Pauline called Kent. But just like with the dispatcher, Kent can't get the clear story. She told Kent that she found Shauna on the floor of the bathroom and that she's dead. And probably just because of, you know, all the emotions and the franticness, Kent thought that maybe Shauna had overdosed and collapsed in the bathroom. And he was thinking that she was just unconscious. He couldn't even believe that she was dead. But of course, he dropped everything, and he and Beverly rushed to the scene. When police arrived, it was clear from the get-go that this wasn't a suicide, and the scene was quickly roped off as a crime scene. "That's when it really hit Pauline," she said, "that someone actually came into their house and purposely hurt her daughter." Shauna, like I said, lay on the floor between the tub and the toilet. An autopsy later revealed that she had 74 wounds on her body, 43 stab wounds to her face, neck, and abdomen, as well as other cuts, slashes, and abrasions. They actually described it as 74 stab wounds, 43 penetrating stab wounds. blood covered the floors, walls, counters, and sink. In fact, Detective David Callan said there was so much blood that they originally couldn't even tell where she had been stabbed. Beside her body, investigators collected 7 different weapons, including 2 steak knives, 2 butter knives, a pair of scissors, and a kitchen peeler. One of the steak knife's blades was actually bent into a 90-degree angle from the handle because of the amount of force. The butter knife was also bent. All these weapons were also determined to come from the house. There was one bloody handprint on the wall just above Shauna's body, and the angle of it kind of suggested that this person had kind of balanced on the wall with their hand while leaning over Shauna. So this was a good chance that this was the killer's palm print, not Shauna's. There were also some bloody fingerprints on a drawer in the kitchen. The forensics teams took samples from inside the bathroom sink's drain pipes and found traces of blood, meaning that the killer had appeared to wash his or herself before they left. Investigators believe that Shauna opened the door willingly for her killer. Either they had just pushed themselves in or she had actually let them into the apartment. The altercation started in the living room, and the evidence suggested that she was dragged to the kitchen, where the killer then grabbed a weapon and started stabbing her. Shauna was able to get away though, and not too badly hurt at this point, ran to the bathroom, the room with a lock. Unfortunately, the killer caught up with her, and Shauna couldn't force the door all the way closed to lock it. It's then believed that the killer used all of their strength to throw themselves against the door. The bathroom door swung open, and Shauna flew back, hitting her head on the towel rack in the bathroom. This didn't knock her unconscious, but it likely dazed her for a bit, or knocked the wind out of her. Enough so that the killer could come into the bathroom and continue the attack. Investigators could also tell through the blood drip patterns that the killer had run back to the kitchen multiple times to grab new weapons. She was stabbed 43 times, 43 penetrating stab wounds. And I'm willing to bet that just one of those wounds to the neck would have killed her. The fact that the killer went back to get a pair of scissors or to get the peeler, that's terrifying. Detectives believed that Shauna knew her killer for a few reasons. One, they think that she let them in. And two, they must have known her routine. Unless this was a robbery gone wrong, which all things pointed away from, the killer must have known that she was going to be home. Home alone. They even took the time to wash up after the murder. So clearly they must have been comfortable knowing that Pauline wasn't going to be home until later. The murder was also incredibly personal. Investigators thought that it was probably someone who got sexual pleasure out of someone else's pain, but they were surprised when they learned that there were no signs of sexual assault or any traces of semen found at the scene. All the weapons used in the murder were also from the Card residence, so this killer came unprepared. Did someone lose their temper? I mean, I don't think inflicting 74 wounds really means losing your temper. I think that's more of a some kind of psychotic rage, but I know what they're getting at. We're going to take a quick ad break, and we'll be back in just a minute. Because they believe Shauna knew her killer, they had to start with the obvious, the family. Investigators were particularly skeptical about Kent and how Shauna had moved out of his house just weeks before. He agreed to take a polygraph, and the first one came back inconclusive. However, he took a second one, and actually during one of the questions, he asked them to rephrase it. He believed it was a leading question. So they did, they rephrased it, and he answered, and he passed. Beverly and Pauline both passed their polygraphs on the first try. Kent did have an alibi for the day, but it wasn't super airtight. He said he was at work, but a lot of the work that he did was alone. So there was actually an hour and a half time frame where nobody could be a witness for him. After he passed his second polygraph, though, and everyone they interviewed said that he really loved his daughter very, very much, they did rule him out. With their family cleared, investigators went door to door at Shauna's apartment complex to see if anyone heard or saw anything that day. They knew the killer had likely cleaned themselves up before leaving the crime scene, but I still have to think there would be blood in their clothes. Unless they brought another set, of course. Though considering that they didn't bring a weapon, I doubt they would have brought spare clothes. Even so, nobody reported seeing anyone looking suspicious, or with blood on them. But the girl in the apartment above Shauna did say that she heard something. She actually went to the same school, but she was 2 grades behind Shauna. She told detectives that she had heard a lot of moving around, like bangs and bumps, but no screaming. She said it actually sounded like someone moving furniture. It's still weird though, that Shauna was chased down the hallway with a knife and nobody heard screaming. The day after Shauna's murder, investigators were combing through her bedroom when they found a notebook tucked away in the back of her closet. A diary, they thought. Inside, Shauna had written several entries about a boy named Marcus, and even called him her boyfriend on a few occasions. She wrote how they had a great relationship, but sometimes they fought, and she wondered if all men were like this. That's what she said. The entries made it seem like she was quite infatuated with this guy. But Pauline and Kent had no idea who this Marcus guy was. Remember, she wasn't allowed to date. But of course, teenagers do keep things from their parents, so police just wondered if maybe she had been dating someone secretly. And who better to know the truth than her friends, right? Police interviewed several of Shauna's friends about Marcus. And some of them were like, yeah, she mentioned this boy she was seeing named Marcus, but we don't know his last name, and we don't know how they met or anything. Which, right off the bat when I read that, I thought that was strange. You're 17, and you tell your friends about a secret boyfriend? That is scandalous. That is the hottest tea. They're gonna want all of the details. Even today, when my friends tell me they're dating someone, I'm like, what's his name? Where did you meet him? What's his social insurance number? Like, give me everything. I'm genuinely curious as to whether there were any female detectives on the case. Because I have a feeling that the girls would feel the same way I do. I don't know, maybe that didn't seem weird to the investigators, and they did continue to look for Marcus, even going so far as to put it out in the newspaper. Looking for Marcus, possibly Shauna's boyfriend, please come forward. But nobody did. There was one guy at the school named Marcus, but he didn't even know Shauna. He might have even been in a different grade. Like, it was not him. There was nobody in her contact book named Marcus. This is the time before cell phones. Plus, Pauline and Kent didn't know when Shauna would have even had time to meet a boy and be in a relationship. She was busy. She did a lot of extracurriculars. She spent a lot of time with her family. Pauline believed that if Shauna had been interested in a boy, she would know. And remember, they were close, so Shauna probably would have told her. The only thing that her family thought of was something that Beverly had heard while she was taking Shauna driving. Beverly had asked her if there were any boys that she liked, and Shauna said no, but then had asked Beverly what to do if a boy likes her, but she doesn't like him. It was in a joking way, too. From the way that Beverly phrased it, it was kind of like, how do I get a boy to not like me? So I don't know if that was like a joke, like, ew, boys are gross, I have no interest in dating, or whether that was talking about a specific person. Detectives even considered that maybe her murder was the result of a jealous love triangle. Some girl's boyfriend had flirted with Shauna, and that girl wanted revenge. Eventually, police had to think of this Marcus thing from a different angle. And after rereading the diary, they started to wonder if Marcus was real at all. They had since talked to her family and friends, and they kind of knew Shauna a bit more now. And with this victimology profile, the writing didn't really seem like the Shauna everyone knew. After holding onto the supposed lead for quite a while, I believe months actually, police came to the conclusion that Marcus was nothing more than a fantasy. This wasn't really a diary. It was more like a journal in which Shauna wrote little stories, or dreams, fantasies. But she didn't have a boyfriend. She hadn't met this mysterious boy named Marcus. For me, this whole made-up fantasy thing made me realize just how young she was. Talking about dating a boy and him doing nice things for her, that's what some 17-year-old girls dream about. And it's sad knowing that she never got to actually experienced that for real. As for the friends saying that they knew about a Marcus, I wonder if they really did, or whether they just wanted to act like they knew what police were talking about. Like, if I'm 17 and police tell me, your best friend had a boyfriend, did you know that? I might just say, yes, because I mean, like, how could I not have known that my best friend was dating someone, you know? So I wonder if Shauna actually had talked to them about Marcus. I mean, I know some people do that. The old, like, oh, he goes to another school. I don't know. I just think if the friends thought Marcus was a real guy, they would have asked Shauna for more details. So investigators are back to square one, and months have now passed since the murder. And you're probably all thinking, Julia, what about the bloody handprint found at the scene? Yes, of course. So let's dive into that. Because it was 1995, these things took a lot of time. They did take the bloody handprint and the bloody fingerprints, and they were ruled out as having been Shauna's. These fingerprints were also found on the knives and scissors and the peeler. While some law enforcement agencies did have access to AFIS, automated fingerprint identification systems, the Integrated Automatic Identification System, or IAFIS, which is the national database run by the FBI, wasn't around yet. So depending on what kind of system they were using, it could have been statewide, or it could have been a really small system specific to their county. Either way, there were no matching prints found in AFIS. As for the blood, in July of 1995, results came back that the bloodstains in the bathroom were a mix of Shauna and a male sample. There were also a few droplets found in the sink and a small stain on a towel that didn't belong to Shauna. It was likely the result of the killer cutting himself. Oh man, I hope he cut himself good. I hope he, like, sliced his thumb and then spilled lemon juice on it or something. Which I know is oddly specific, but it happened to me like a week ago and it really stung, so fuck that guy. Anyway, at first, I believe they just got the blood type of the killer, or maybe like a partial profile. They didn't have a full profile yet. Technology was still working on that. But they began comparing all of her friends and family to the blood type. While I don't know what the blood type was or what kind of indicators that the partial profile gave, it was certainly a good start, because after taking samples from like 30 people, there were only two that they couldn't rule out, and that was Shauna's father, Kent, and a fellow high school student named Jason. Obviously, this doesn't mean they were the killers. If there were 30 people that they tested, well, actually, it was 27 to be exact. So 27 people and two of them couldn't be ruled out. That means in that sample group, 7.4% of people weren't ruled out. So basically right now the investigators have a partial profile or a blood type that will eliminate 92.6% of people. Even still, I don't believe investigators thought that either of these men, Kent or Jason, were the killer. Because one, a criminal profiler had come in actually to do a profile of the killer, and she said that she believed that the disorganization of the crime scene pointed towards someone young. And because they were able to walk away from the crime scene without seeing anyone, they most likely lived nearby. Kent had passed a polygraph on his second try, but still, he passed. He was at work at the time of the murder, and even if there was a period of time where nobody saw him, like, I don't know how you'd stab someone that many times and then return to work without any blood on you. I know the evidence showed that the killer cleaned themselves up a bit, but I feel like there'd still be some blood. And lastly, Kent was just genuinely distraught about his daughter's murder. He was considered a person of interest for maybe like the first week, but he was pretty quickly ruled out. As for this Jason guy, I'm not really sure why he wasn't looked into as a suspect. Police had their reasons, of course. I assume maybe he had an airtight alibi, or maybe he lived far away. For whatever reason, they didn't think he was suspicious. And so with nothing else, the case stalled. Shauna's family continued to send reminders of their daughter, sending the investigators cards with Shauna's pictures, just trying to keep her in their minds. They hosted fundraisers to raise reward money, but it didn't produce any solid leads. Then, fast forward to the fall of 1997. Investigator David Callan was going over the file again. He was sure that whoever the killer He had already talked to him. But at the same time, he knew that it wasn't someone he had taken DNA from. So, who had they talked to, but not tested as an actual person of interest? Well, there were a few people that investigators had briefly talked to, but hadn't necessarily taken DNA from. Like, people from the apartment complex. At the very start of the investigation, police had gone to the apartment complex seeing if anyone had heard or seen anything. Well, they were just treated as witnesses, not suspects. So some of these people didn't have DNA taken. Detective Callan looked back at the files, and one name stuck out. Jimmy Bedoya, a 16-year-old high schooler at the time who went to school with Shauna and lived in the complex. The note said that the investigators had talked with Jimmy, his older brother, and his father during their first canvass of the neighborhood, the evening of the murder. Jimmy mentioned that he went to school with Shauna and that he had a class with her, but he didn't really know her. When asked if they heard or saw anything, they said no, and both boys said that they were actually just chilling in their room after school. Their father said, too, that his sons were home. And so not only did Jimmy appear to have an alibi, but he hardly knew Shauna. So because of that, police never asked him for his DNA. Detective Callan was looking for anything to get the case moving again, even if it was just crossing the T's and dotting the I's. So Callan called Jimmy, who was now 19 and no longer living at that apartment complex. Callan explained on the phone that the case was still unsolved. They'd taken samples from lots of the other classmates, and they were kind of just being extra thorough. Jimmy was a bit hesitant at first, but Callan assured him that it would take 5 minutes. He would even come to him. So Jimmy said, sure. The next day, Callan went to get a saliva sample from Jimmy. But he remembered that when he was talking to him, Jimmy wouldn't look him in the eyes, and he just kept staring at the ground. Weird, but investigators talk to shady people all the time. Callan left feeling pretty indifferent. He even said to Jimmy that he would let him know when he was eliminated. That's how unsuspecting he was. In March of 1998, Callan was notified from the lab technicians that Jimmy Bedoya may be their guy. The DNA didn't 100% point to him, but he couldn't be ruled out either. Detective Callan immediately began looking into Jimmy's record and learned that he had recently been charged with a misdemeanor offense. Callan was then able to pull up that file and find Jimmy's fingerprints. Those were then sent to a latent print examiner, who compared them to the fingerprints found at the Shauna Card crime scene, in blood, on the murder weapon. Those came back as a match. Police were now confident that they had their killer. They did have enough to arrest him at that point, but first investigators wanted to see what Jimmy had to say. So they brought him in for questioning, without telling him that his fingerprints were a match and that his DNA was consistent. They asked him how well he knew Shauna, just like before, and he said he didn't know her. He thinks maybe they had like one class together, but that's it. Investigators then asked him if he had ever been to Shauna's apartment, even if it was just to go in and use the phone or borrow a textbook, and he said no. They got him. I mean, they had him anyway, but they don't want him to be able to say, oh, well, my fingerprints were there because, you know, I must have been there before, which is exactly what he tries to do. When they do confront him with their evidence, Jimmy says, well, maybe I was there a week before the murder and I just can't remember. Considering this interview is 3 years after the murder, he could have forgotten. But then police bring up the fact that not only were his fingerprints on the murder weapon, but there was his bloody fingerprints and palm prints. And his DNA is consistent with some of the blood found at the scene. They were really looking for a confession here, so they could have something to give to Shauna's family. But Jimmy continued to sit there and say, quote, I'm telling the truth. I wasn't there that day. I don't know what happened. End quote. So unfortunately, it looks like a confession isn't going to happen. But either way, they arrest him and charge him with murder on March 9th, 1998. The motive is still a bit puzzling. But investigators believe that Jimmy went over to the house that day and Shauna let him in. Of course, it's possible that there was no sexual motive or love angle here, but it's possible that he had had a crush on her. When Shauna asked Beverly how to get a guy to not like her, maybe she was talking about Jimmy, but who knows? Either way, she's polite, so she invites him in. They talk for a bit in the kitchen, but after a while, the mood shifts. Maybe Jimmy made a move that Shauna didn't like. Maybe he just started being creepy. Or honestly, Shauna knew that she wasn't supposed to have boys over when her mom wasn't home. So maybe she just told him to leave. It's believed that Jimmy snapped and hit Shauna in the face. Then he grabbed a knife from the kitchen drawer. Shauna ran to the bathroom to lock herself in, but Jimmy was in a complete out-of-control rage, and she couldn't fight him off. He stabbed her in the neck with a knife, and once she was incapacitated on the floor, he ran back and forth from the kitchen to get other weapons. Jimmy was not only her neighbor, but he even rode the same school bus as Shauna, so he probably knew that her mother didn't get home until later. He took his time, washed himself up a bit, and then all he had to do was return back to his apartment in the same complex. I don't know if his brother and dad lied for him, because remember, they'd originally told the police that they were all home that afternoon, and that both sons were just chilling in their rooms. It's possible that Jimmy had just left the house, and his dad genuinely thought that he was in his room. We don't know. But I also have to imagine if my son came home with blood on his clothes, I'd have some questions, to say the least. Let's stop here to do a quick ad break, and we'll be back shortly. Jimmy Bedoya's arrest was announced in the papers, and Shauna's family was overjoyed. But, of course, confused. They had never even heard of this guy. Jimmy's lawyers were quick to point out that the DNA evidence was not fully conclusive. But fortunately, after his arrest, the samples of his DNA, as well as samples of blood from the crime scene, were sent out of state to be tested. Further testing was able to determine that the blood mixed with Shauna's and the blood droplets found in the sink and on the towel was not just consistent, but a match to Jimmy Bedoya. The two other samples from Jason and Kent Card were also sent, and they were officially ruled out. These tests were very thorough, too. Not only did they get DNA from his saliva, but they also took a blood sample, and everything matched up. Jimmy Bedoya went on trial in November of 1999. His defense team, led by Buck Blankner, had a strange strategy. I guess this is all you can do when the case against you is that strong and your client refuses to plead guilty, but they kind of just ignored all the physical evidence against him and just asked the jury, why? Why would 16-year-old Jimmy Bedoya have gone over to Shauna's house and brutally murdered her? He didn't even know her. He had no connection to her. So how does that make sense? Their whole argument was the lack of motive. And without a motive, it just wasn't plausible, they said. Blankner also did briefly try to say that the fingerprints on the knife could have been left there at another time, and that they didn't necessarily tie Jimmy Bedoya to the murder. But that kind of contradicts what he said earlier about how they didn't even know each other. They didn't know each other. There was no motive or prior connection between the two. Yet you're saying he had been at her apartment before the murder and left fingerprints? I'd also love to know what he said about Jimmy's blood being mixed with Shauna's and the bloody palm print, but I don't think he addressed that. Jimmy Bedoya also did not take the stand, which is not surprising. But even so, his demeanor told the jury enough. I wouldn't go as far as to say that he was laughing, but he was grinning the entire time. Kent Card said that to him, it appeared as though Jimmy was enjoying himself, probably enjoying the attention. He very clearly thought he was going to get away with this, and he just did not appear to be concerned in the slightest. And Pauline said that when they showed the autopsy photos, which must have been horrific, he didn't even flinch. So really, he showed exactly what kind of person he was without even saying a word. The prosecution, led by Jeff Ashton, called the evidence against Jimmy overwhelming and told the jurors in his closing statement that he, quote, applauds Mr. Blankner's imagination. End quote. It's the best backhanded compliment. I love the savagery. The prosecution also made the smart decision not to go for the death penalty, even though they could have. At that time, you could still seek the death penalty for offenders under 18, but they didn't. Because even though that he was 21 when he went on trial, the jury would probably still take into account that he was 16 when he committed the crime. And then it really becomes like a bigger issue of sentencing someone to death for something they did when they weren't an adult. I'm not even going to get into it. It only took 3 hours for the jury of 8 women and 4 men to come back with a guilty verdict on first-degree murder. A month later, on December 17th, Jimmy Bedoya was sentenced to life in prison without the possibility of parole. 2 years after his conviction, he appealed on 2 grounds. One, that the state couldn't prove premeditation, and therefore it shouldn't have been first-degree murder. And 2, that his Miranda rights had been violated. When taken to the circuit court, it was noted that Florida Statutes 1995, quote, provides that premeditated first-degree murder is the unlawful killing of a human being when perpetrated from a premeditated design to affect the death of the person killed or any human being. Premeditation is defined as more than a mere intent to kill. It's a fully formed conscious purpose to kill. This purpose may be formed a moment before the act, but must exist for a sufficient length of time to permit reflection as to the nature of the act to be committed and the probable result of the act. Evidence from which the element of premeditation may be inferred includes the nature of the weapon used, the presence or absence of adequate provocation, previous difficulties between the parties, the manner in which the homicide was committed, and the nature and manner of the wounds inflicted. End quote. So, with all that in mind, was this murder premeditated? Well, let's start with the weapons. Bedoya used 7 different weapons, leaving the bathroom multiple times to retrieve another kitchen utensil with which he could hurt Shauna. Blood evidence showed that the attack had started in the kitchen and that he had chased her down the hall into the bedroom. The court found that, quote, the manner in which the murder was committed and the nature of the wounds reveal that the murderer expended much effort and energy, engaging in a violent and continuing attack against Shauna. We agree with the state's argument that chasing the victim from one room to another, running back and forth to the kitchen to get weapons, and switching willy-nilly between 7 different weapons, shows Bedoya spent quite a bit of time perpetrating this crime. End quote. Now, on top of that, there's this presence or absence of adequate provocation, or previous difficulties between the parties. In this case, it was said that Jimmy and Shauna didn't even know each other. So therefore, there is no evidence that Shauna provoked the attack against her. And I know that the way that that's phrased kind of sounds like victim blaming, but it's just said that way for legal reasoning. Because provocation can be used as a defense. If someone kills someone partly because of a preceding set of events, you could argue that that might have caused them to lose self-control. This isn't in any way saying that it was the victim's fault, but it's supposed to decrease the idea of malice afterthought. Anyway, so I know I read a lot of quotes there, but basically the appellate court agreed with the state that just because they didn't have a motive, it didn't necessarily mean that it couldn't have been premeditated. So even though they couldn't prove that Jimmy knocked on the door that day planning to kill Shauna, he took his time with the murder, he put a lot of effort into the violence, he had a fully formed conscience to kill. The next issue was the violation of the Miranda rights. Jimmy Bedoya said that after he came into the station for questioning, the investigators asked him if he had ever been in Shauna's apartment, to which he said no. But they never read him his Miranda rights before asking that. So that statement shouldn't have been allowed in court, they were arguing. However, Miranda rights don't have to be read if the person isn't in custody or in a formal interrogation. And Jimmy wasn't in custody. He came into that police station voluntarily. All police did was ask if he would come down and answer some questions. He could have said no. He was not under arrest. He was not being held. And investigators had made that very clear. His other complaint about his rights was that the interview was videotaped and recorded without his knowledge, But the court was able to just simply say that police officers are allowed to record you without consent. Honestly, I was kind of confused as to why Jimmy's team even filed this appeal. I'm not a lawyer, and obviously they know what they're doing more than me. I'm not doubting that. But they would have had to know that they would lose this appeal, right? Unfortunately, the nightmare wasn't over for Shauna's family. They'd have to go through it all one more time. Because in 2012, the Supreme Court ruled that life sentences given to those who were juveniles at the time of their crimes was unconstitutional. And so Jimmy Bedoya's sentence was allowed to be reviewed. Shauna's family and friends were terrified that he would be granted a more lenient sentence and actually created a petition to help keep Jimmy Bedoya behind bars. In April 2018, 40-year-old Jimmy Bedoya appeared before the court, as well as Shauna's friends and family. And for the first time, not only did Jimmy actually confess to the murder, but he had a reason, apparently. He now said, 23 years after, that he was actually high on PCP at the time of the murder, and he wasn't in control. However, Detective Callan testified that when he first chatted with him, the evening of Shauna's murder, when he was canvassing the apartment complex, Jimmy seemed, quote, stone cold sober, end quote. And this would have been just hours after he had killed her and was supposedly high on PCP. Jimmy's lawyer said that Detective Callan's memory must have just failed him, but Callan insisted that no, he had talked to this kid the night of, and everything seemed normal, because he wasn't high at all. After the drug story, Jimmy, again, for the first time, gave an apology. Quote, "Sir, by the grace of God, I have been afforded this opportunity to accept responsibility for my involvement in this awful act and offer my sincerest apologies to the Card family." Unquote. Then he turned to Pauline, Kent, and Beverly. Quote, "Mr. and Mrs. Card, I am truly, deeply sorry for ending Shauna's life. May God bless her soul. There hasn't been a day that's gone by that I'm not reminded of the wrong, the harm, and pain that I've caused you." End quote. But Shauna's loved ones really don't care what he has to say. They don't want his apologies. It doesn't bring back Shauna. And they don't want excuses. Shauna's stepmother Beverly Card said, quote, "I don't care that he was on drugs or it wasn't on drugs. He still made the decision to kill our daughter, and she doesn't get a second chance." End quote. I also find it incredibly convenient that now, when he has an opportunity to get a new sentence, that he decides to confess. He decides to apologize. And he even has an excuse that's supposed to excuse his responsibility. Oh, I was high on drugs. Where was all this during your original trial? He didn't show an ounce of remorse before. None. But now that he's getting a second chance, he's all of a sudden a reformed individual. He stabbed a completely innocent girl 74 times. Then for 3 years, continued living his life like nothing had happened. Went to school the next day with everyone grieving over their friend and their classmate. The judge must have shared the same thoughts, and in 2020, re-sentenced Jimmy Bedoya to life in prison without the possibility of parole. As of March 2023, he is incarcerated in Marion County, Florida. According to the Facebook page Justice for Shauna Card, he will have one, and only one, chance to appeal. This year, actually. But Shauna's family isn't too worried about that. If he was recently resentenced, there's not much hope for an appeal. But if he does try, I'll keep you guys updated. Shauna's loved ones still keep her memory alive. They post memories and pictures in their Facebook group and cheers to her on her birthday. Shauna would have turned 45 this year. They wonder where she'd be. Would she be a mother? Would she get to work in physical therapy? But they'll never get to know or see Shauna grow up because of the actions of Jimmy Bedoya. I just hope they can get some peace knowing that he's behind bars and will be for life, and that Shauna can now rest easy. Thank you guys so much for listening to another episode of Always Time for True Crime. While you're waiting for the next episode, you guys can go follow me on social media All the links are in the show notes. And if you want some say on what kind of cases I cover, become a patron, because I just posted a poll there about what cases you want me to cover next. So become a patron to get access to those kind of polls, ad-free episodes, and tons of bonus content. Stay safe out there, guys, and I'll be back soon with a new episode.